very prevalent for therapists, especially the beginning therapists who want to rush in and help and move, utilize their try hard driver to a large extent and put a lot of energy into connecting. And as I'm saying, often the client can feel overwhelmed and withdraw even more.
Totally. Which
And then
again, it does come with experience, you know, and I know we've spoke about it in other podcasts, you know, silence can be quite profound in a therapy room and having space.
We demystify what goes on behind the therapy room door. Join us on this voyage of discovery and co-creative conversations. This is the Therapy Show, Behind Closed Doors podcast with Bob Cook and Jackie Jones.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to episode 82 of the Therapy Show, Behind Closed Doors, with Bob Cook and myself, Jackie Jones.
Gosh, so 82.
The last one of this year.
It's the last one of the year.
The last one of the year. And what we're going to be talking about is attachment, which I think is quite apt. I'm attached to seeing you every Thursday, Bob, when we do these podcasts.
So to attach, yes, and you, of course. So
thank you.
Attachment styles. Now, I trained people for a very long time in transaction analysis and now integrative transaction analysis. And both of the models are contact-oriented models. In other words, there's an emphasis on connection and, as important, interruptions to connection. Okay, so it's important to understand attachments because connection and attachment are in the same ballpark. And there's been so much written on it. I mean, the sort of major theorists over the years have written many, many different ideas on attachments. Probably the just as Freud was the father of psychoanalysis, I think Bowlby was probably the father of who talked many years ago about different attachment styles. Also Winnicott, who was a child psychoanalyst, talked a lot about attachment styles and what that actually means in terms of connection, disturbance, and how they how people with different attachment styles function in life and the problems that may or may not bring. So connections, attachment styles are really important, I think, for therapists to think about. And the templates of also templates for working clinically in terms of treatment planning, etc., is really important. So it would be odd, you know, Jackie, in any training of psychotherapists, if you didn't have at least a weekend on attachment styles. Be really odd. So I could talk about many different things, but if we talk about very briefly Bowlby's different attachment styles, we've got avoidant attachment, we've got anxious attachment, we've got ambivalent attachment, we've got disorganized attachment. So we've got different attachment styles, and there's many books being written about the different attachment styles. But I'll kick off and say one of the things I think about, despite what attachment styles they come from, is how the person attaches to me or doesn't attach to me in the therapeutic process and what that means. Is a really good starting point for me. What about you?
Absolutely. And again, you know, from my own personal background, being a foster carer as well, you know, the attachment and how that impacts a relationship going forward is really important. My own as well as theirs, because there's always two people you know, involved in that connection. There's an energy going from one to the other. It's not like it's just about our attachment style or theirs. We connect with each other theoretically. Mm. So yeah, really important.
So in your fostering experience, I can explain this. Were you taught attachment processes, or did you learn them yourself, or?
Well, I trained as a nursery nurse. That was one of my first jobs. So Bowlby was quite, you know, we did a lot about attachment styles and everything. But, you know, obviously in a nursery setting and a school setting, you know, that first day at school and how different children react differently to that first day at school and being left, whether it's in a nursery or whatever, and how that can, you know, impact on a child, how it's dealt with. You know, it's not a trauma, but dependent on how we deal with it, it is traumatic.
I would think any, I know nursery nurse, but I was just thinking fostering again. I would think that all the kids that you dealt with would have had severe ruptures in attachment.
Yeah, yeah.
From significant others.
Yeah. And how that manifests is surprisingly unique to each individual child as well.
Gosh, how did you find that?
Through doing it for 12 years, do you know what I mean? It's like I never took it for granted how a child was going to react or respond to me, because they were all unique, you know, from regression, having a strapping 15-year-old teenage boy completely regressing in their behavior, you know, and not being what you expect. You, as a female, feeling quite daunted by this, you know, 6 foot strapping lad walking in, to being met with somebody who was displaying a much younger age in front of me.
And what caused that, do you think?
But obviously they're in child ego stage, you know what I mean? That complete shift and reverting back to how it was for them in a past life.
Yeah, I've got that bit, but I probably haven't indicated what I meant. What was the trigger for that process? You know, what triggered the regression, do you think?
The fear of the unknown. They didn't know what they were walking into.
Right, that's what I was getting to.
Yeah.
So that's exactly, yeah. They didn't know what they were going to walk into.
Yeah.
And how could they attach to you?
A protection, yeah. You know, it's self-survival and all those sort of things. But yeah, it is unique. You'd get the ones that there was all bravado, do you know what I mean? That you were nothing to them. And, you know, that bravado would be there for a while, to them not even acknowledging you were even there. They'd walk into your house and not even have eye contact with you.
Because?
Again, it's a, you know, it's a self-preservation, but if they've got an ambivalence attachment style, or you're not going to be here, you're not going to stick around, so I don't need to make contact with you. You're not that important to me.
Yeah. You see, I think the way you're talking is really important, because you're talking from a developmental perspective.
Yeah.
And when we think of attachment styles, we need to think developmentally. Yeah. Because, how can I explain this? The attachment style is essentially a coping mechanism to survive, whether it be ambivalent, whether it be anxious, whichever way we look at this. People choose these attachment styles, if you want to say the word choose, as a way of coping in life.
Yeah. And the other thing that really used to strike me, again, particularly with the fostering, but probably in the therapy room as well, is that, you know, their behaviour was a way of communicating something to me.
Absolutely.
Without the spoken word, whatever they were displaying in their behaviour was a form of communication, and it was up to me to try and decode that a lot of the time.
I think that's really, really important, what you've just said. And often they're non-verbal behaviours. Were a clue to what was happening.
And
if you understand attachment styles, so for example, if somebody regresses in front of you and withdraws and doesn't speak, or regresses to a place where they don't have contact with you, then if you understand attachment styles in a developmental perspective, it gives you a clue to what's going on and how to be.
Yeah.
In the therapy room.
Yeah. Because we all have attachment styles. It's part of being a human being. You know, we can have a very... This is one thing that always used to come up for me in training, was we can have a really healthy, appropriate, happy childhood. But we will always have something from that that we take into our present. You know, it's not all doom and gloom, but you know, having a healthy, happy life means that we would probably have a very resilient attachment style.
Or put it in Bowlby's term, a secure attachment.
Yeah, style. Yeah. So it's not just about the bad stuff. Even, you know, if you nothing ever goes wrong, which is highly unlikely in your past, you will have behaviours because of your past experiences, whatever they are, whether it, like you said, it's really secure and it's trusting and everything, but that's based on your experience of growing up.
That's right. And if we think developmentally, there's a concept from TA, which I really like, which is the four existential life positions.
Yeah.
Which you can put together with attachment styles. So for Byrne, the four existential life positions that we learn in childhood as a way of coping, if you like, you'd have, I'm okay, you're not okay.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not okay, you are okay. The most resilient of them all, of course, I'm okay, you are okay, that secure attachment.
Yeah.
And then the, which often leads to disorganized attachment, is I'm not okay, you're not okay.
Yeah.
Now, if you put them across with the attachment styles, if you know, if you think about it this way, somebody who's got an I'm okay, you're not okay position, existential position, they're more likely to not trust people, to have a disorganized way of thinking, perhaps because they don't trust themselves, they don't trust other people, they think everybody's out to get them, they're more likely to perhaps move to a position of homicide or even move to a position of attacking.
Yeah.
Because they see the world in such a scary place. Somebody from I'm okay, you're not okay, is much more likely to go to a paranoid position, and the attachment is going to be pretty avoidant, really. So you can start putting these existential life positions with the attachment processes, and you get quite a comprehensive diagnostic system.
Yeah.
How you can treat or work with people.
I did find the life positions, or the OK Corral, or whatever you want to call it, really helpful. I refer back to that again and again and again.
Yes, because these life positions will also reflect their attachment styles. And you know, in the therapy room, sounds like you think of the existential positions in terms of diagnosis quite a lot.
I'm bringing it into the client's awareness as well, that we, you know, we do have these different places, you know, on how we feel about ourselves and the other person. But I am quite educational in my sessions, and I like it. I like structure myself, so to be able to talk with that, you know, tool with a client, I find really useful.
That's right. So if somebody's got an avoidant attachment, for example, they're going to be quite withdrawn.
Yeah.
And they're not only going to be quite withdrawn in terms of the physical energy, but also in their energetic response to you.
Mm.
So they'll be quite passive.
Yeah.
And next bit is how you contact or attempt to contact somebody from an avoidant place, because usually their motivation to connect with you will be low. Now, the next question I always used to think to myself, well, not a question, a statement really, was that, well, they had enough motivation to come to therapy.
Mm.
So their desire is to connect.
Yeah.
It's just their history is against them.
Yeah. Yeah, which is really interesting. You know, how do you connect with somebody? Because, and again, when I said earlier on about, you know, it takes two to make a connection. And I'm quite happy talking about me personally. But for me, you know, I've got quite a strong please others and a people pleaser. So if I've got somebody that's quite ambivalent about making that connection, it's really easy for me to constantly try to make that connection with that person.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it, because it may be they have a relational need for initiation which hasn't been met.
Yeah.
And at the same time, one of the dangers might be that they would be overwhelmed.
That's exactly my point, that to dip in and dip out is okay for some people. You know, for me, out of my awareness, it's I've done something wrong if they disconnect. So it's really interesting, the dynamics that can take place around attachment styles.
I think what you're talking about is very prevalent for therapists, especially the beginning therapists who want to rush in and help and utilize their try hard driver to a large extent and put a lot of energy into connecting. And as I'm saying, often the client can feel overwhelmed and withdraw even more.
Yeah, totally. Which, again, it does come with experience, you know, and I know we've spoke about it in other podcasts, you know, silence can be quite profound in a therapy room, and having space to just hold the client, if that makes sense, rather than trying to fix the client all the time.
Yeah, another podcast we should have should be about the dangers of attempting to, inverted commas, fix clients.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the only person that can fix the client is themselves.
Yeah.
But the beginning therapist will certainly often come from that position.
Yeah. I did in the beginning. That was why I went into, you know, fostering and nursery nursing and being a therapist. It was, you know, my past. It was my job to fix people. I soon learned that that's not the way to do it.
Well, the problem is the only person in the end who can fix themselves, unfortunately, is the client.
Absolutely.
You can help them on the way.
Yeah.
You can help them become more aware of their coping mechanisms, their script decisions, and how it, you know, plays out today. And in the end, they're the only people who can really take ownership and responsibility for change. However, beginning therapists particularly, and often very experienced ones, fall into this trap of perhaps trying too hard or overhelping, and the client then feels overwhelmed and overstimulated and moves away.
Yeah, and I think with experience or you know, just learning to be okay with ourselves as therapists, you just start to back off a little bit with clients, and the impact of that is quite positive, I think. And having an awareness that, you know, my state of mind fluctuates as much as what the client does, and sometimes I will be in my script, but being aware of when I'm in my script is really a valid thing to do, and to be able to be authentic in the therapy room.
Well, that's why the UKCP, which is the United Kingdom Cancer Psychotherapy Regulating Body, requires all people who are trained to be therapists to have at least 40 hours of their own therapy per year.
Yeah.
Which it's 160 over 4 years of training.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is exactly what you're talking about here, is that they have enough awareness perhaps to be aware in the moment. They're acting out from their own script.
Yeah.
And change it, or at least get to a place where they can move to an adult position.
Yeah.
Whereas clients, of course, you know, are usually unaware they're acting out the script.
Yeah.
So I think the therapist, from my position, I think they have a duty to actually understand their own script and understand their own therapeutic process, so they don't merge with their clients.
Yeah. Yeah, and understanding that we have attachment styles as well. You know, we're not immune to all of the things that we're working through with our clients. We also need to work through on ourselves, exactly like what you were saying. Yeah.
Now, if we can stay an adult, we won't act out so much. But the clue to all this is your own therapy.
Yeah.
And I always get appalled. And pardon me for all these counsellors that might be listening, but I always get appalled when I am reminded that the BACP, which is the regulating body really for counsellors, don't ask for any counselling and their counsellors to have therapy themselves or counselling themselves. I know most counselling programmes may demand that if you're trained to be a counsellor, they should have some counselling. It's not required by the regulating body, but even so, quite often people in counselling training are only required by their training bodies, whatever body it is, to have 20 hours,
yeah,
4 years, and I think it doesn't help them, not in the long run.
Yeah, I often joke that I didn't realise there was anything wrong with me until I started doing my therapy training. I thought I was fine until I started training.
Yeah, and I think that's a very common reaction. And then 4 years later, you realise that you've dealt with a lot of challenges. And
yeah,
with clients, then you're more able to be aware of when you're in script quicker.
Yes, yeah.
I'm not saying that you won't move into script and still be unaware of it, but you have at least you have more chance to get out of script quicker and have some reflection and therapeutic process so you don't merge with your clients.
Yeah. And again, supervision is always really important with all of this.
Yeah.
You know, not just personal therapy, but having supervision that you can take things to as well. Yeah.
You are right about, though, what you're talking about, which is the reflection that therapists come often for their own attachment styles.
Mm.
The point I'm making there, though, is if you have therapy, you know, consistent therapy, you can become aware quicker of your attachment styles.
Yeah.
And maybe, hopefully, move to a more secure one.
Yeah.
Where you don't act out in the therapy room.
Yeah. Because I think for me, you know, and again, I might be looking through rose-coloured glasses or whatever, but I'm very aware of my attachment to the clients. You know, it's not like it's just a job and I go in there without me personally being in the room, if that makes sense. It's not clinical for me. It's important that I do connect with the client and that there is a relationship that builds up over time with that client, and I'm invested in that.
Well, I like to call it a clinical relationship.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I think that's important. It's not that, you know, I think it's important because you work with the clients will have a clinical focus. And part of the clinical focus, because I've known you a long time, is relationship is important.
Definitely, yeah.
That the relationship aids cure for the client in the long run. So
yeah.
There's a clinical thinking about having relationship in terms of the therapy that you do. It isn't like the relationships you have at home or socially or
there's absolutely not. No. Yeah.
Focus. I think that's important to mention. Otherwise, you know, there can be no differentiation in relationships. So I know with you is a clinical focus here.
100%, but I also need to be completely authentic and transparent in that relationship as well.
You talk about the therapist-client relationship here, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. Because for me, I think clients can sniff out if you're not being authentic.
No, you're absolutely right. But the question is, I agree, and that's a great, I have the same principle as you, and that will lead to curative functions. And the reflective question is, A, how do you know you're being authentic? You know, and your authentic is and all that sort of stuff we talk about. And for me, let's use TA terms for a minute. To be aware when you're in our script or not will only come from reflection and therapy of your own.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you'll know whether you're being authentic or not.
Yeah.
But I agree with you that the aim is an authentic clinical relationship where you build up a robustness so that the client can trust you in a safe place to be able to do the work they need.
Yeah. And, you know, to finish up with, Bob, like you always say, you know, therapy is a, you know, it's a process, not an event. And that goes for us as well. You know, it's not as soon as we qualify that we've got all the answers and everything's fine, because life will throw us a curveball and it is a process.
Mm-hmm. You're right. And hopefully we can offer our clients a space for secure attachment.
Yeah.
Because it's from that place that awareness and cure is most likely to happen.
Yeah.
And of course, again, I'll say that a person's attachment style is their coping mechanism. So to get to a place of secure attachment is a process, not an event.
Yeah.
That's what you've just said.
Yeah.
But I do think for a therapist to think developmentally and think about connections and attachment styles and the interruptions to contact is a wonderful template for the way forward clinically, positively. Mm.
Yeah. Definitely. So thank you, Bob.
You're welcome. If this is our last one of the year, what a way to end.
I know, yeah. I think it's a really good place to end. And maybe what we should do next time is, you know, what do we do if a client leaves unexpectedly?
That's another one for a podcast.
Yeah.
Another one, of course, is a wonderful book that Eric Byrne wrote was called What You Say After You Say Hello. Mm. In 1969, all about script theory.
I've got that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, what do we say from the moment of beginnings with our clients?
Mm.
What do we say after say hello? It'd make a good podcast, wouldn't it?
It would. So it'll be a surprise when we come back in the new year what the first one is going to be. Who knows?
Yeah, 2023.
Yes.
God, I'll be 73.
Well, yeah. I don't even know where the last 3 years have gone, Bob, to be honest.
Well, I hope it's a wonderful new year for you and
you too.
Yeah. And here's to that, your health, and also many, many connections through podcasts. And you said earlier, I wish you all the viewers in our YouTube channel and listeners a very good new year.
Yeah.
If that's the right word.
Yeah. I think that's a lovely way to end. Yeah. And a happy new year.
Absolutely.
Okie doke, Bob. Until next time. Thank you so much.
Yeah. See you in 2023.
I'll see you next year. Yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
That way. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Therapy Show, Behind Closed Doors podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. We'll be back next week with another episode.